This is The 10th Voice, Kansas City's gay and lesbian radio magazine. The 10th Voice, because you refuse to be silent.
And good afternoon, and welcome to The 10th Voice. I am your host, Philip Blue Owl Hooser.
Hello.
Oh, boy, do I hope everybody's being heard. It's a week for that. We are devoting today's entire show to an event that happened this week on the other end of Missouri in St. Louis because it has a lot of people hurting and a lot of people wondering. And this week, America's third largest religious denomination, second largest Protestant denomination in the country, met in its general conference in St. Louis. The United Methodist Church, you may have heard about this, voted to reinforce a policy dating back to 1972 in their Book of Discipline that says, the practice of homosexuality is incompatible with Christian teaching. In the course of the General Conference, they rejected a plan called the One Church Plan, which would leave individual churches to decide about queer clergy and same-sex marriages and other issues, and voted 438-384, it's the same digits, just in a different order, for something called the Traditional Plan, which includes penalties for breaking those rules and asks those who would disobey to find another community to go to. Following the vote, many Methodists, both the LGBTQ and allies, took to social media to share their despair and their devastation over this. And so this is today's show is kind of a response to that, because I personally read many friends' posts that were heartbreaking. So there may be tears. They may be mine. We're here because there are many, in general, many LGBTQIA people of faith and many individual churches that are supportive allies. But a lot of people are right now wondering what happened and why and what can be done and what is their place in a community that some now find to be not just less inclusive but exclusionary, and what could happen to the Methodist Church? Could there be either a schism or a schism, however you decide to pronounce that for yourself? And what is their place in this, if any? I should let you know I'm not a Methodist. I was raised a Southern Baptist, so there's no hope for me. and Elizabeth has heard me tell the story of why I ended up leaving that. But I'm not what you might necessarily call a traditional person of faith or of a religion. But I think that this is important in the larger overall issue of what is happening with such as things like so-called religious freedom laws and the queer community. So I have assembled some really wonderful people who are willing to come in and some who feel that they really have to fight for and about this issue. So with that, we now have 55 minutes to solve this entire problem. Save the cheerleaders, save the world. So, toward that end, I would like to introduce my guests. First of all, there is the Reverend Steve Jones of Keystone and Revolution. KC, Revolution?
Yes.
Or just Revolution?
Just Revolution.
Oh, just
yeah.
Revolution. Why not have it all? Steve, if you would, I should also let you know, I was trying to get Adam Hamilton because I thought, what better thing than to have our religious representatives for this be Adam and Steve?
That would have been beautiful.
See?
See how it works?
That's what I was saving. If you would, tell us...
I'm Michael.
who it is you do, what you do, and why.
Sure, sure. Philip, thank you for the opportunity to be here.
Absolutely.
I am a pastor in the United Methodist Church, and I do serve, as you say, Keystone and Revolution, which are United Methodist churches in Westport and in Waldo. Both of these churches are what... In almost coded Christian language, we call reconciling. There are churches that are welcoming, inviting to all people, including the queer community, to be in, not just in worship and present, but to be in leadership, part of guidance. And so that's where I am. I came out of a background of law. I was an attorney, and then about 5 years ago entered into the ministry and have been at these churches a little more than 3 years.
And in the interest of full disclosure, I have spent a lot of time with Steve on stage and off stage, but
yes,
certainly on stage, including feeding him gummy worms from my own mouth. That's a whole other story.
A great story.
We don't have time to get into that. We also have with us Tex Sample of great fame and activism, a famous author of many, many books, and his name actually is Tex. It's Tex's given name. So let me get that microphone as close to you as I possibly can. And if you would, sir, in your lovely tones that sound like home to me, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm pastor of Trinity United Methodist Church in the city. Trinity has been a reconciling, welcoming, inviting church for years.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, in the 80s, people in our congregation took folk who had AIDS into their homes to care for them. So our congregation, did I say, is half gay and lesbian. So.
That is my favorite quote from you this week in the news.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, being the pastor of that church is just an absolute thrill. It really is. I mean, I enjoy. I tell them I don't need the money and I don't need more work. I just like them. And let me just say one quick thing that to me is the most compelling argument I know. In terms of LGBTQIA folks plus, I know dozens of gay and lesbian people who are in marriages.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the best marriages I know in terms of their morality, their Christian commitment, their devotion to discipleship, their engagement in social action and in proclaiming the good word. I mean, some of the very best people I know. To suggest that this is incompatible with Christian teaching is simply mindless. Mindless. So that's where I come from.
So, Steve, you were there. Tex, you were observing. Tell us your observation. Tell us what is it that happened?
Well, sure. The General Conference of the United Methodist Church is rather like Congress in the U.S. government.
Oh dear,
I know. In good and bad ways, much of the United Methodist Church is set up not unlike the U.S. government. That we have bishops who are sort of like the executive branch and a judicial council that's a bit like the Supreme Court. And this is sort of our legislative gathering. Normally they meet every 4 years, but this was a special call to conference to address specifically issues of human sexuality. Since 1972, as you say, that language has been in the Book of Discipline, and pretty much since 1984, there have been efforts at those quadrennial meetings to change it or to get rid of it. And there was hope that this was the time that it was actually going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
It turned pretty quickly. It became pretty evident fairly quickly that there was a gathering made up both of more conservative pastors from the U.S. as well as pastors and delegates from the U.S. I should say that within the Methodist Church were represented both by pastors and by lay people.
Mm-hmm.
in equal amount. And so that the delegates, both conservative ones from the U.S. and from Africa, Asia, Europe, had formed a coalition, and that was no surprise to anyone, but that it was going to be strong enough to carry the day to strengthen the penalties for this abusive language.
And I've heard it said that the American Methodist churches have kind of been a victim of their own success. in their missionary work to Africa and the Philippines, that in the late 19th century, carrying this missionary work to spread the word of Methodism and create more Methodist churches, that the teachings of that time and the conservative nature of the politics sort of have carried over in those countries. And even one of the African delegates I read a quote from said, we don't need Western enlightenment on these issues.
Let me respond to that, because it is true that the United Methodist Church is a world church.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look carefully at the voting in this last conference, it was a very large delegation from Africa, which is growing, and primarily across the southern part of the United States, where you tend to have a more reactionary view of homosexuality, for example. But it was the coalition of those two groups that gave them the numbers to outvote. Mm-hmm. I would say that two-thirds of the delegates from the United States would have voted to change that language, or at least to move to the plan that would have allowed local option. So that, yes, we were, and I say we were defeated by that coalition. Let me say, too, that the contradictions within that coalition are enormous. I'm a Mississippian by birth and raising. I have never known the South to be right about a major issue. It takes them 100 years and so forth. I don't mean to suggest that the North was right about slavery and Jim Crow and the rest. You know, Fannie Lou Hamer used to say there ain't no down South, up North, out West in the United States. There's a down South, an up South, and an out South. but by the same token, has it been right? In Africa, homosexual practice is outlawed, mm-hmm. and you can be severely punished for it in Africa. And you had a very active coalition. There's even evidence that some of the delegates from Africa were given a couple of $100 apiece by some of the money. And we've got right-wing money coming into the church through various kinds of channels. That's very hard to trace, but I think it's a very reliable claim. So we've got some of those kind of dynamics going on. And before we're done, let's talk about what we do about it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And phones, too, is my understanding. Both money and
Phones were given, yeah.
Yeah. So it's sort of like the bishops came in with what was called the One Church Plan.
That's right.
So they would be representing, like, Congress and the lawmakers, and then the Tea Party comes in with his traditional plan.
it's probably a pretty good analogy. The intention, I think, of the General Conference really was to acknowledge that that we have great division in our denomination mm-hmm. around this, and to answer the question of can we continue to be a common denomination with shared values and beliefs, and yet have a difference on this, and continue to be celebrating the grace and love of Jesus Christ in one place. And so I think that the goal was to make that happen, and pretty quickly it turned to an idea that perhaps that's not an option at this point. The One Church Plan is probably much less affirming than many of us would have liked, that we think the language should just be eliminated, but the One Church Plan in theory would have allowed for folks who affirm same-sex marriage and those who think it is not correct to still be in one body and relate together.
And Tex, you have also been a great advocate and activist. Don't reconsider that. I'm going to say that it's
great is a big word.
I've been
active.
Active and big in your activism. What have you been doing? What do you think can be done?
Okay. Let me say two or three things. A lot of people are saying now we ought to leave the church, and I want to urge people not to do that, at least initially. That may be something we have to do down line. But let me suggest instead that the right wing has instituted a church with this plan that it cannot govern.
Mm-hmm.
And so I am suggesting at least two major kind of strategies that I want us to reflect on. I mean, I can talk about the tactics of each of those, but here are the ones that I would suggest that we begin reflecting on, looking how we can put them into play. Let me say one other thing. We've got our judicial council meeting around this plan that was approved in April. And my hunch is they will throw out any number of provisions within it. We could talk about that later if you like and need to. Let me suggest two strategies. I like the strategy of refusal and what I call the catacomb church. Now, what I mean by the strategy of refusal is, and it's what I'm going to do, it's what I'm doing, is that we simply have churches all across the United States say we are not going to obey this ruling. We simply will not do it, and we're not going to leave.
Mm-hmm.
We're also not going to punish people. We're not going to bring them to trial. So you created this mess. You violated our conscientiously held convictions. Now you've got to enforce it. And then, for example, if they say a pastor is no longer pastor of a church, I suggest that the church say, oh, yes, he or she is. They're going to stay there. We're not going to support the pastor you send in. We're going to support this pastor. You know, that's one thought. Mm-hmm. I'd like to look at that with some people. Another possibility would be to say, if our bishop supports the appointment of gay and lesbian people in the church, and you say our bishop is fired, then we will move that bishop into other offices to support that bishop and not support the one you bring in. I mean, those kinds of ideas.
Yeah.
The point is, if the two-thirds, well, I doubt that it's two-thirds, but if the majority of the churches in the United States say we will not be, you know, subjected to this kind of violation of our convictions,
mm-hmm.
and then act in ways that they will not be, the right wing cannot govern the church. And I think it would probably be a good idea for them in the United States to leave it.
Rather than building a wall and, say, making the Baptists pay for it.
I got a lot of good Baptist friends, you know, and who take a position similar to mine. So, I think we really can. I think we can have the kind of standoff here that I don't think the right wing was prepared for. There's a sense in which they might have been prepared to lose.
Mm-hmm.
And I would invite them to take the strategy of moving out because they've got something they can't govern.
And on that note, we do have some messages that we would like for you to listen to. And we'll be back with some more members of our discussion group today.
Does this spot wants to know what's on the next Arts Magazine show?
Thank you, Paul. The Unicorn Theater will be with us to tell us about their show, The Humans: Heart, Hilarity, and Humor.
Some of my best friends are actually humans.
Tensions reach a boiling point, and every man, woman, and human bubble up. That's Monday at noon, Arts Magazine.
President Trump has renewed his vows to conservative Christians to clamp down on abortion.
There are a lot of people who are either never Trumpers or somewhat skeptical of his character flaws who might be willing to vote differently if that issue were taken off the table.
That's next time on Interfaith Voices.
Tuesday at noon after Lynx Mix.
And we are back. We are talking about the recent vote, which is not yet law, church law, I must say, of the United Methodist Church, that has left people with some confusion and delusion. Toward that end, I also have three wonderful people who have agreed to be here today to talk about their experiences within the Methodist Church. Share us a little bit of their stories and involvement. Tim, we're going to start with you.
Excellent.
Tim is always distracting for me because he's one of those cute ginger boys. and also a very, very dear soul. So take that and just let it be, okay?
Well, okay, I'll take it.
A wonderful person.
But only from you.
Okay. one of the earliest posts I read on Facebook this week was actually yours. And it was so heartfelt and kind of heartbreaking. And I thought, if there's someone who is really at the heart of this issue, I think that it's you. Your background, your involvement with the church.
It starts actually before I got involved with the United Methodist Church. I grew up in a denomination that was very, very conservative, and the damage that can be done by a decision like was made this week, I've personally experienced a number of years ago. I grew up in a denomination that was not affirming at all, not welcoming. And based on what I perceived to be their stance, I entered into an incredibly intense season of my own where I was ready to turn my back on everything, and there were more than a few times where I was ready to just end it all. I call it my suicide season, and it's not a very clever name. It's pretty blatant. The beautiful poetry, I suppose, the resolution of that was it was my faith that essentially pulled me out of that. And I began looking for a church that was inclusive, and somebody suggested a United Methodist Church. I went to Church of the Resurrection downtown for about a year, and then I got poached by another church up north of the river to come play piano and sing for them. And I started as with a three-month contract with them, just to be an interim between pastors, and I was doing that as a favor. And I was there for, I want to say, 8 years. Those contracts are always a little nebulous. The overwhelming support and affirmation that I got from these people, it made it a pleasure to serve in the way that I did. And I took great pride in, not only in the fact that I was supposed to be just interim, but also in how much longer I ended up being there. And when that church merged with another, they created a space for me. They have been so affirming. I was invited to tell my story from the platform one Sunday, and the love and affirmation I got from that congregation only increased after that. So I felt incredibly valued, and so this decision this week came kind of as a shock to me, because it was not something that I had experienced in the Methodist Church at all. It felt like I was being told by a group of people who don't know my name and know nothing about me, that everything that I had done, my years of service and all of the hours that I'd poured into every project, were null and void. It meant nothing. It was worthless. And therefore, everybody that might have been touched or moved by anything that I had done had been then nullified. And the emotional roller coaster of this week continued, I guess, with all of these. I was inundated. Even today, I've gotten several messages from people within the Methodist congregation who have been so incredibly affirming and loving. I've heard and read the phrase "I love you" so many times this week, and that's meant a lot. But what has meant more, I think, is that other three-letter phrase or three-word phrase that we like. I need you, and that, I mean, that does give me hope. Not everybody is in the same boat that I'm in. Some people are just congregants. It's easy to love the guy who's on the platform, and my struggle has been hard enough this week. I can only imagine what it's like for the people who, for the nameless faces that are out there, who've just been told that they are, you can enter the throne room of grace, but you have to use the back door. And it's offensive, it's insulting. it's paltry, and it's so trivial. It seems unnecessary and needless.
My friend Kevin posted earlier today that he felt like now he was regarded as a second-class citizen.
Yeah.
And it's devastating to me.
It is, and it does seem like a step backward. And I had a friend who's a woman in clergy this week in the Methodist Church. Maybe 72 hours had gone by, and somebody called her the fact that she was a woman into question as to whether or not she was even viable. And I thought, great, what's next? Do we dust off the whites only signs and put them back out front?
Mm.
Yeah, the signs have physically been destroyed, but they're still in the back of people's minds. So, is that what the next step is? I hope not. I don't think so. But it's not. We're not going to avoid that without people taking action.
And speaking of people who have taken action, and women and clergy, although she's not so clerical, one of my co-hosts here on the 10th Voice, Elizabeth, is joining us today. Elizabeth, tell us your story.
Well, I grew up in several churches. We went every single week. I went to Sunday school, heard all the sermons. First Presbyterian, my dad was a deacon. I was confirmed Presbyterian. My whole mother's family were missionaries and ministers. My mother actually was born in China to Presbyterian missionaries, and my whole family went to Park College in Parkville, starting in 1900, I think, my great aunt. And then I was catechized Anglican, went through catechism, because my father's family is Anglican. And then all through high school and college, I was very active in the Swedish Evangelical Covenant Church.
Who hasn't gone through that phase?
And then in southern Oklahoma, really it was a choice of Baptist or not, so mm-hmm. I went to Baptist a couple of times. My mother's family is also Southern Baptist. And
I should also mention this is a part of the country I'm very familiar with, where they will ask the question, without any irony, are you Christian or Catholic?
Yes. Yes. In fact, I noticed when I went to Lawton, Oklahoma, that there were pages and pages and pages of pawn shops and Baptist churches. But in 1980, I came to work and teach at Rockhurst, a Jesuit school, so there's also a Catholic element because my sons and both graduated from Rockhurst, and met in a book group Ted and Cindy Winstrohr, who invited me to the Methodist Church, and I loved the social works, and I loved what I perceived as liberalism. And so in 1981, I joined the Methodist Church. My sons were confirmed by Dr. Albert Cole and went to Sunday school, and my sons were born and raised Methodist. And then when I came out in the mid-90s, I came out to my Sunday school class, and they were shocked, but supportive. And my son's father sat beside me while I did that. But I did not come out to the greater church. And I envied those people who did, but it felt safer to be don't ask, don't tell.
Mm-hmm.
And in 2005, 2006, we had a minister, Amy Gearhart, and I can remember pacing the halls of the Weston Crown Center. I was in meetings. I came out to her. I told her who I was. I told her that the word incompatible bothered me. And we really talked it out about, you know, being mothers. And then Jim Simpson became pastor, and I wrote a letter to him about the word incompatible. Got a lovely note back. And he invited me. Tom Poe was going to join him and talk about LGBT and Central and the Methodist Church. And that's when I stood up in the meeting. I was toward the back, and I had friends in the room, and I came out to the church. I was emotional. I started crying. I had no idea I was going to do that. Not a clue. And then, again, I'm an editor, so the word incompatible means something to me.
Mm-hmm.
It means I don't matter. And the new minister, Trevor, I wrote in the little blue slip in the pew that the word incompatible was still stuck in my craw. a lovely one-page note back from him. So I've always kept a certain fondness for Central United Methodist in Midtown. And I've heard Emmanuel Cleaver give sermons from the pulpit, and I have a lot of memories there and a lot of friends. And actually this week, what really bothered me is I read all the blogs, I read all the posts, was I was really mad at what happened at the General Conference, but I was proud of my church, which in an overwhelming vote became reconciling and has been very supportive.
And I mentioned earlier that I had hoped our clerical representatives would be Adam and Steve, but of course, one of my favorite things that anyone has ever said is, of course it's not Adam and Steve. Never Adam and Steve. Adam and Stephen. And toward that end, I'm going to call our next guest Stephen, so that he is not confused with Steve. It's that difference between gay names and straight names.
Okay. Actually, Stephen.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
We may have to check which one was a V or a PH.
So, Stephen DeWild, what is your story? What is your experience? And what are you thinking?
Well, it's a whole different journey than Tim and Elizabeth's. Since I started life, as I refer to many friends, as I was in the womb Methodist, because my family comes out of four branches of Methodism that all married together.
That's a womb with a view.
Yeah, no kidding. My grandmother was Methodist in England before she immigrated with her family to the United States. So I pretty much was just born into the church. And we were talking beforehand, and what I didn't share with Elizabeth is I grew up in a little country Methodist church in northern Indiana that was built by my great-grandparents on their land and by lumber from their sawmill. So it was a church that
wow.
was just part of my life. So in the process of moving to college, graduating, getting jobs, I'd always just moved to a new, different Methodist church. And in my case, it's a bit different than Tim's, is I'm kind of halfway between Tim and Elizabeth on this one. I did not come out or even figure out that I was gay until after college. Because the period of college I was going to school during, there really were no gay or lesbian role models. I mean, you lived what was the image of a male life and was what was expected of you, and you didn't think about it a lot. So after I came out, it was the standard traumatic coming out. But once I was through, I never questioned my faith or my church. Because it just didn't seem to be a big deal. Even after 72, when the incompatibility clause made it in. So when I moved with a job to Kansas City, immediately started looking for another church. Elizabeth and I didn't realize that we both walked into Central United Methodist in the same year.
1981.
I fell in love with the warmth that I found in that church. I fell in love with the music program. For me, a church with a big cassavant pipe organ and a really good choir, you know, touched me in really good spiritual ways. And so joined the choir, and the rest is history. Eventually moved my membership, and that's where I've been ever since. My other part of my journey is while I was still working, I was working with Hallmark for almost 30 years and was active in the diversity councils there. And
which is astonishing to me because you don't look a day over 30.
Well, thank you.
My family's also Southern, so I come by that naturally.
Oh, there you go. But it was interesting working with the LGBT community there because questions of faith also came up there. And so I also had, through the church, been to conference. So I was a conference representative for our church, had become aware of some publications that kind of helped people through the what I refer to as the scriptural gotcha verses that people like to use against gays and lesbians. And there's some real good writings out there by really good theologians who've said those are usually used inappropriately, out of context, and being misinterpreted. So I help people get publications to kind of help them through their own fight with that. And within Central, though, at the church, it seemed like it was never an issue that needed to be discussed. I found the church constantly warm and embracing. Late 80s, early 90s, my partner and I at the time went through the challenge of his AIDS diagnosis, and the church was just a support group for both of us. And after he passed, the church was my support group. And then I was lucky enough to find someone else in my life. And the church supported him. Now, he was a convert. He was not a born Methodist. He converted.
Oh, that kind of conversion.
Yes.
just wanted to make sure.
Yeah. He converted into the Methodist Church for me. And when we got married, the biggest surprise I had was, because at the time, the Methodist Church, we couldn't get married in our church.
Mm-hmm.
So we used another facility. My pastor at the time couldn't officiate, but we did a full, huge service of Christian marriage. All of our Catholic friends were thinking it was just going to be the standard Protestant in and out. No, it was an hour-long service because we did full Eucharist also. So my pastor was able to assist in Eucharist, even though he couldn't officiate the service of the wedding. We had friends, when they got the invitations, made the comment of, well, why aren't Brad and Steve getting married at our church? And then suddenly looked at each other and went, oh, that's right, they can't.
Mm.
So that was the kind of reaction we had, and it's been consistently supportive. Our church in the last year finally made the decision, even though they behaved as a very inclusive church, to finally take the very positive action of becoming a reconciling congregation. So we worked with the Reconciling Ministries Network. They have a very long, in-depth process to work through, knowing that not everybody in a church who appears to be warm and embracing may be ready yet. So they really help you through the process so it's not a sudden shock when you take the vote to become. So we had done that just before last year. And so then we had conference this year. And so it felt a lot like having a bomb dropped in the middle of everything you'd accomplished. So as Tex mentioned early on, it's too easy to make that sound like a text message. Sorry, Tex. I think what our brothers and sisters on the right didn't anticipate is centrists and progressives tend to get along pretty well with everybody. That's the goal. But if you do something and step on it too hard, it's a bit like stepping on a hornet's nest. And through all the posts of disappointment I've seen and read from friends, what I've also read and heard from so many people, because our church had a kind of a follow-up meeting on Wednesday night that you came and said,
I did,
which was great to see you there. But I saw so many people in that room that have always been supportive, and I really have this sense that people are moving from being supporters to being activists, and I hope they don't just give up. I hope they truly look for ways of how I can work with other organizations, with the Reconciling Ministries Network, which is quite well organized, to say how we go from what just happened to what can be or should be.
before we get everybody back together to share further thoughts and ideas, did any of you have anything that you wanted to add or carry on further?
These are deep, deep feelings. My father never missed a week of church. He was a deacon in the Presbyterian Church. And when the Presbyterians became more inclusive, he never, ever set foot in a Presbyterian church again. He reads the Bible every single morning at breakfast. He and his mother have worked their way through the entire Bible, except for the final book. They don't approve of the final book. But they read verses every single morning, and they've made their way through the Bible, I think, four times. And he has never set foot in church because it accepted people like his daughter. And I had a best friend in Oklahoma in the 70s, and in the mid-90s, after the divorce, I decided to tell her who I was. Her words were, "People like you have destroyed the Episcopal Church." And I feel sorry for Marshall. And I never spoke to her again. And she has since passed away.
For anyone who doesn't know, Marshall was your husband.
Yes, yes. Who's a wonderful person who has always supported me. Wonderful father. And anyway, to have your former best friend say that, these are deep, deep feelings. And it's hurtful. It's just plain hurtful. And so I understand completely what Tim said.
Yeah, and I think, if I remember correctly, Tim, in your post that I recall, it said it's difficult not to take this personally.
It is. I mean, I went into the Methodist Church thinking this is a place where I can be safe. This is a refuge, and outside of the arts community in Kansas City, this, you know, it's my last one, really. Because they were so open and so affirming and just, you know, so wonderful, it felt like a slap in the face. And so to hear all of the positive, incredibly encouraging things that have been said to me directly after this by people who are in the know, people who are in power, and to even see the other things that are being said by other people across the metro that I've seen, and around the nation, really, that's great. It's wonderful. Wounds still take time to heal. So I am of two minds, really, at this point. The thing that has really sunk in with me is that all of these people have validated my work and my, you know, and everything that I've contributed. So it almost feels like a call to action. Well, you know, it's time to make myself more valuable. I need to be more productive. I mean, I do what's asked of me every Sunday, you know, and if there's special projects come up, absolutely. You need another cellist for Christmas Eve? I'll do it, by all means. But suddenly that's not enough for me anymore. I am bound and determined to, and rightly or wrongly, prove these people wrong. Because this was one of the first places I discovered that truly embodied the limitless love of God. And I mean, if you're going to preach it, you may as well show it. And so far in my experience, that has been the Methodist Church, but clearly not universally. And I don't know that it's fair to make the comparison and say, well, you know, those are the African nations or whatever. I mean, yes, it is. It is illegal to be gay, but we're seeing little hints of that here in America too. Mm-hmm. And in Africa, being gay is enough to get you killed. But it's kind of that way in the States as well. So, you know, you just end up in the wrong place at the wrong time and oop, there you go. So, I mean, when I say it is a sort of a refuge, that's not a stretch. That's not an exaggeration. It really is for a lot of us who need somewhere to be.
Stephen?
Well, Tim's comment, knowing the journey you went through emotionally with all this, is, I think, all of us, some of us dealt with it in different ways. Mm-hmm. But I think you went through this process of shock, disappointment, but I think a lot of us, it then turned to anger. And one of my biggest concerns for the Methodist Church in the United States especially is when something like this happens, all churches, whether they're affirming formally or like your church, very affirming, even though they aren't formally a reconciling congregation, we all get painted suddenly with the same paintbrush that the denomination is painted with. Mm-hmm. And so it would be my hope that LGBTQIA plus people of faith out there don't discount the Methodist Church because of this one action. There are thousands of congregations in this country that are affirming and embracing and mm-hmm. totally disagree with what's happening. So there are places for all of us, but then we just need to figure out how to join forces.
Absolutely.
And help make this a more positive outcome.
And we'll talk about some of those ways here in just a moment. I'm hoping, as we play musical chairs yet again, at this time, our wonderful Linda Wilson, I have some audio that I would like for you to play. And if possible, can you pipe that into the studio for us so that everyone in here can hear that? This is a... wow. This is a young man who aspires to be a pastor, a Methodist pastor, who spoke at the General Conference. And his name is Jeffrey Weaver, J.J. Weaver. Passionately, fervently, and gosh, it's something I think everyone should hear. So here's that.
So a speech for J.J. Warren, microphone one.
My name is J.J. Warren from the beautiful Upper New York Conference, and I am a lay reserve delegate. I want to speak for this motion because I think there are subtleties that can slip through that we may not have been aware are unconstitutional. And for me and the younger generation that is the church now among you and who want to be the church together with you for the future as well, we desire a church that seeks the justice of God, a church that doesn't waste its money on a conference and come out with no decision because it was unconstitutional. The pain that would happen from this crucifixion of putting the nails in our Methodist church, the pain of this death might be worth a resurrection, but I'd like to see first if that can happen together without being called unconstitutional with whatever we decide. So I support this motion to put this before the Judicial Council so that we together can make a decision for the church, hopefully one that ensures that wherever we are, the United Methodist Church continues and allows people to feel their calling that God has put on their heart, no matter whom they love. So that is my support. And as someone who has grown up in our church, as someone who is gay and goes to the least religious college in the U.S., my evangelism on campus has grown. We have brought people to Jesus because they said they have not heard this message before. They didn't know God could love them because their churches said God didn't. And so if we can be a church which brings Jesus to people who are told can't be loved, that's what I want our church to be. And that's the Methodist church that I love and that I want to be a pastor in one day. I want to be a pastor in the Methodist church because I love our tradition. I love all of you. We are
together. This is the body of Christ, and we are stronger together than we are apart. And no plan to separate us can unite us like God's love. We are the church. We are God's children. Let us be the church together.
All right, thank you.
Some good, strong words.
Amen. Yeah.
And a few tears around the table. very, very impactful. We are stronger together. Always a good message for us to remember, I believe. So everybody is back around the table. Elizabeth is lurking over my shoulder. but a friend of mine pointed out that there's a bit of irony in that the forces that brought forth the traditional plan want people to be more adherent to the Book of Discipline than they probably are to the words in the Christian Bible. And so with that, I saw Tex furiously scribbling some notes so that he could get some ideas in. So I would like to start with you, Tex, please. And anybody else, when you speak, just for clarity for people who are listening to this, I think people may recognize Tex instantly, or Elizabeth in this group of voices. But if you would just introduce yourselves to say, you know, hi, I'm Steve, or I'm Stephen, or just to get things clear. So Tex.
I'm Tex Sample. I'm pastor of Trinity United Methodist Church in the city. Our congregation is half gay and lesbian, and we've been at the forefront of this work for decades, so this is not new to us. I want to say once again that friends out there, do not leave the United Methodist Church, because the right wing has created a policy by which it cannot govern. And what we need is resistance all across our church to this egregious form of church policy. I was talking with Reverend Bob Hill in the city just this week, and he said, you know, culture eats policy for lunch. That's I'm sorry, that's actually Drucker's comment, but Bob was quoting it. And what I want to say to people across the United States, I mean, the majority of our delegates in the United States voted against this traditionalist plan. And we, as someone said here, we've got thousands of churches who are reconciling churches, do not agree with it. Build resistance. One other possibility for the churches who are in areas where they would suffer far more, constraint, even coercion, then I would recommend for people and churches in those places what I've called the catacomb church. In other words, we can do all kinds of things in secret we may not be able to do publicly. So if you're in that kind of a setting, for example, how about a catacomb wedding? I can imagine gay and lesbian people who would love to have a catacomb wedding. You could do it at midnight. You could do it in the church. You bring the license. If you have to have somebody from another denomination sign the license, that's fine. Have a great UCC brother, sister come in there and sign that license. And then, man, go to work and marry those folks. And then the rest of their life, they can say, I was a part of that movement. I was a part of what changed this country. I want you to know that I had a catacomb wedding. All right. Go.
Oh, can I get an amen?
Amen.
I preach in two churches where Tex preached previously, and you can imagine that that's miserable for us.
It's my understanding that parts of the traditional plan have already been found to be unconstitutional by the Methodist Church Constitution. If you can imagine the conservative group coming in and trying to make laws that are unconstitutional. What can be done? What can be done, and not only with people in the case of the United Methodist Church, but also for people who are fighting things like these so-called religious freedom laws that are trying to be completely at odds with the gay community, the queer community.
Yeah,
Steve, you're up.
I am. I would say that things to what I will tell my congregations on Sunday, one of the things I will share with my congregations, which are both LGBTQ and straight, is to continue to be in relationship with one another. You know, I'm very aware that Tex and I are here, and we are cis, straight, white males, because in many ways that is your option for Methodist pastors to come and talk. And from that perspective, we can only speak to our experiences, but I think we're both very aware that there is so much pain that has been caused by this process. And I think before action is taken, there has to be a time allowed for grieving. And so for our communities and for my communities, I will invite them to not run away from that to start with, to let that anger and that grief be there and be present, and beyond that, to be in relationship with one another, to invite others into that relationship, and to share that grief, to share that anger, but then to move on into deeper action, whether that is action at a political level, whether that is action at a church level of being louder, of being bolder, and from folks like us who are allies of adding our voices to that, but not trying to be the ones who speak on behalf, but be the ones who can amplify.
As Stephen was saying, to go from being a supporter to an activist.
Yes.
Yeah. Which also sounds like Tim, what you were saying.
Absolutely.
To be more active.
Well, and recently, my generation in general has kind of been jump-started into the sort of activist phase anyway, just on the political scene, and I love the idea of partnering with all of these churches who now, for lack of a better phrase, have been outed as, you know, people who are supportive and affirming and encouraging, and so the hope and the possibility that has just reared its head is exciting. That part is thrilling. I'm very much looking forward to that. The healing part, that's going to take a minute.
Mm-hmm.
It does feel like a betrayal in some ways. But I love your stance and your program at this point, looking at, you know, deal with the healing part. But, you know, the change is coming. We've been told time and again that joy comes in the morning. Sometimes it doesn't wait till morning.
Midnight.
Sometimes.
Midnight in the catacombs, yes.
As one thing that was said that I took with me from the meeting at Central was this may not be a time to react, but it is definitely a time to reflect.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I think that a lot of people are going through that. Stephen, did you have something? Stephen, talk. Speak.
We all heal in different ways. Mm. And some of us heal by getting more involved. And anybody who's been involved in the church, most of us, well, some of us, because we've done so much, we've gotten deep into how the polity and governance of the church works. But so many don't. And it's important for members who want to get involved understand how conference works, how voting works, how delegates are put in place. And that will also help make us stronger. So that becomes something that feels tangible, even if you can't fix the system, is get involved, get educated.
So as to the larger issues of these, you know, religious freedom and the LGBTQ, any thoughts on where we can go with that? Oh, Elizabeth has one.
I think the presence on social media is having a huge effect because there are a lot of friends. I just heard from a friend in Ecuador, and she said we need to be more active, and I absolutely think that seeing friends and acquaintances who are responding in a healing, healthy way is, and of course some outrage, it's very, very helpful to see that you're not alone. Mm-hmm. And it makes a big difference, and people are responding around the world.
And with that, we are almost to the end of our program. I don't know that we've necessarily solved anything, but I hope that we brought some comfort, if not healing yet. Comfort helps with healing. I want to leave you with the thought that regardless of what that meme on Facebook has said, there's every clear indication that Yeshua or Jesus actually did say something that was affirming about LGBTQ, certainly queer men at the time, and also had the opportunity to heal the lover of the Roman centurion, and he didn't say, "Now your lifestyle is disgusting. That's why I won't do it." No, he said, "Let's go, just right away." Mm-hmm. So I don't understand how some people come to ignore that as the teachings. It astonishes me. Thank you all very much for being here. Thank you for Jason, who showed up at the studio thinking he could be a studio audience. That was lovely. Thank you all for listening. And this is an issue that will continue to follow. You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. If you keep listening, you'll hear Out Here Now. And keep your heart open. Keep listening to other people around you. Thank you so much.